All right, I think we'll go ahead and get started. Thank you guys for coming. I think probably most all of you have heard kind of the about Steve or heard him speaking already. But Steve is the Director of Communications and Development at the National Council of Churches. He's a United Methodist pastor and a filmmaker. And we showed his film on campus several times the last couple days, and we've actually just been having conversations over here at the table because he's headed to North Dakota tonight, and it's going to be at Standing Rock tomorrow with a clergy protest, and we are hoping he doesn't get arrested, but if so, he's promised us to write a really great book. So, Steve.
Thank you, and I think the topic for discussion today is the current state of interfaith and DC and how that's working, and I can talk a little bit about that, but I also think it would be helpful for me to tell you how I got into the whole thing and some techniques that I've tried to use in doing peacemaking through video and film, and give you an example of that, show you an example of how I'm doing that. I don't know. I'll just be repetitive in case somebody hasn't heard what I had to say in some other setting that I was in. It's all running together in my mind right now. I really got into the... Well, I guess it was in chapel yesterday. I described how I got into filmmaking and how I noticed that there was something that could be done there. But I actually lied in chapel. Yeah. It was actually a step back further than that. That really was the eye opening event in my life that made me start thinking about that. And it was through refugee sponsorship. I got a call one day. I was a pastor in a small town in Upper East Tennessee, and I got a call one day. And I was in a particularly good mood that day, and congenial, and I didn't hang up on the telemarketer who called me. Which is usually what I did back in those days. And I was nice, and this person called and said that they were from Bridge Refugee Services, and would they like to, would I be willing to receive a packet of mail, of information about refugee sponsorship? And I'd never heard of such a thing, so I said, sure, that'd be great. Again, I was kind of nice that day. And I got the package in the mail a couple of days later, and about a week after that first call, I got another call from Bridge saying, "Hey, we've got a family of Bosnians that are sitting on on the tarmac right now, and they need sponsors. Would you be willing to do it?" And I really did hear God's call in that, and it seemed to me to be the ideal kind of experience for my church. I mean, again, hear how I was listening to that in that moment. I wasn't really thinking so much about the refugees who were coming in, but I was thinking about how the experience might be very good and formative for my congregation. Maybe too many times we do mission work and development work in our local churches with the wrong orientation, but maybe even God can use that sometimes. But we did take in that family. It was it was the first time I'd really experienced the problem of a mixed marriage in a strife-ridden country and context. It was a woman that was Orthodox who had married a Muslim man, and the children were, by virtue of that, officially Muslim. But and that had been just fine for a number of years until war broke out, and then suddenly everybody was having to choose sides, and they had to all go on the run. So through that, I also when you bring in refugees, part of the big party that's involved in that is the meeting at the airport. And when they come off the plane, you try to bring some people with you, bring a crowd to greet them, and you try to make a diverse crowd. And then the refugee sponsorship agency will also try to connect other people. And this group of hijabi women came to the airport. And there was a group of men, and then there was a group of women, and they were all covered. And my mind was blown in that moment. I thought, I didn't have any idea this would be something that was present. And this is 1995. I had no idea that there was a Muslim community living in East Tennessee. So, again, that's kind of the background for how I got into when I decided to make a film. It was called Muslims in Appalachia because that's how I kind of encountered the issue to begin with. And again, in the chapel talk yesterday, I told you about how I noticed that the camera has a power to communicate not just content and not just entertainment, but to really connect a person with the viewer because of what I was experiencing as I was editing people. I had some funny experiences later. I did another film a couple years later dealing with American Islam, and there was I spent an entire, like an 18-hour day just doing nonstop interviews in Toledo, Ohio, and then, you know, again, I spent several months going through this footage and reviewing it and cutting out pieces. And we had the occasion to show the film to the community, to the Toledo community, the next year. And this woman walks up to me and she says, "Oh, I'm so glad to meet. I'm so glad to see you. I don't know if you remember me, but you interviewed me for your program." And I was like, "Are you kidding? Do I remember you? I've been looking at you for the last year, you know." And I just, again, I kind of realized that I know them. I know the people I interview, but I'm just the guy behind the camera most of the time to them. But in any case, I noticed that I was being changed and my heart was being changed by encountering people on the screen. I knew I'd met them, but I was kind of wondering if, in fact, the process could possibly be a process that would work, even though with a casual viewer, if you did it right. In other words, you might be able to develop media that connects people when you can't have a sit down. My background in any kind of whether it's evangelical work or if it's any kind of dialogue, you know, you always have a table, right? You always have a table. There's always a table that's set a certain way, and you try to arrange it so people can see each other. And all of our sacred traditions have a meal involved in those conversations. And the sacred meal plays such a very, very important role in the work of reconciliation and community in all faith that I'm aware of. And so I understood always that was the best thing you could do. But we can't always have a meal with people. We can't always sit down with people. And so maybe video could be a good second best, a good substitute. Maybe it could help. There's some people really trying to do that big time. I tried to do it big time. I just, you know, I'm an utter failure as an entrepreneur, I suppose. But Unity Productions Foundation is a nonprofit that does this all the time, and they are working to create good video products that share the best of interfaith. I'll tell you a little bit more in detail about it. If I can remember to talk about it at the end of this talk. But I became part of a coalition in D.C. A year or so ago called Know Your Neighbor. And it was started by a young Sikh man who worked for the White House. And he wanted to try to create a network by which people of all faiths, not just the Abrahamic faith, but all faiths, could take each other more seriously and encounter each other. There was a big public policy piece to that project, but there was also a big social media piece. And again, we tried to use the centerpiece for the social media campaign was a video in which we tried to do that. We tried to connect people through that, you know, through that medium. Now, how do you do it? What's the technique? Ever since MTV came along, you know, MTV was revolutionary because it just introduced this very, very fast-paced editing to where you never stay on a shot for very long when you're watching it. And it seems like everything followed since then. So if you're doing an analysis of something like a Star Wars movie or something like that, you're noticing that no shot lasts more than maybe 3-4 seconds. Nothing lasts very long. Nobody ever stays on a face. It's always cut up. And the way that it looks like when you're dealing with it on an editing software is that you've got your big long video clip, and then you do what's called an L cut, and you cut the way it looks on the timeline is you've got video up here and then you've got audio down here, and you have video and audio running all the way down for, let's say, a 20-second interview cut. What you would normally do is you'd cut it right about here so that the viewer was no longer looking at the face. You left it on the face long enough that you can, you know who you're listening to. But you cut it right about here, and then from here on out, for the rest of the clip, you're cutting to things they're talking about. So if they're talking about a boat, you show a boat. If they're talking about an airplane, you show an airplane. So you understand what I'm saying? How many people have actually done this in this room? You know, you've done it. Come on, yeah, you know. So that's the normal way to do it. And after MTV, it got faster and faster and faster, so that you don't really ever have the chance to sit on there and savor. So what I tried to do is wonder if instead of this much, you stretch it out to this much or this much. In other words, let the camera linger on the face a little bit longer. Maybe, you know, I mean, you still have to do it so that people will watch it. And a lot of editing a film is a musical skill. It's understanding composition and tone and tempo and pacing and how to make a crescendo here and a decrescendo here, and this is triple F and this is triple P, you know. It's understanding how to pace things so that somebody stays engaged. I'm not always good at that, but I at least understand the principles. So you have to fit into that scheme, but what if you just left the camera on the face a little bit longer? What if you let the camera sit on somebody long enough that they could tell a story in such a way that you could really connect with them? So I'm going to show you a couple of examples from a film I made. It's my latest effort. It's still kind of old, 2012, but it has a good marketing title. It's called Islam in America, The Christian Truth. How's that? It's really cool, too, because I made this DVD jacket on it that's got flags and stuff all over it. So it looks like this real, you know, it looks like, hey, I know what this, they're going to, this guy, this film's going to sock it to them, you know. But actually, the film is about Muslims and Christian evangelicals who are working together and understanding each other and essentially end up in a position where they're promoting each other and protecting each other. So the clip I'm going to show you is a story that's told by a young woman. She's a Muslim. She lives in Johnson City, Tennessee. I've known her ever since I first did Muslims in Appalachia. Her father and mother are Bangladeshi, first generation. And so she's a second generation, American kid growing up in America and everything. She's going to talk about some experiences she's had with covering. Now, covering is a controversial topic, right? Because we know that the popular attitude toward women who cover in this country is, oh, they're being oppressed. Oh, their rights are being taken away. Oh, this is about male domination. Oh, this is about, I mean, we can go down the list of what what the popular perception is, the popular narrative is about that. And what I tried to do was to let her speak from her perspective and show it in a film in the way that somebody might have a better chance, not just of connecting with the knowledge, but with her humanity, which is, I think, the key. So let's see if we can dim the lights a little bit.
We bring together Christians and
the
Muslims.
First voice is Rick Love, who that's also important. Rick is a
many approaches we have
an activist, an evangelical activist trying to build bridges between Christians and Muslims.
The basic structure is the pastor shares about love of neighbor from a Christian perspective, the imam shares from an Islamic perspective. We have some Q&A and eat a meal together. In our case, first we went to a mosque, then they came to our church, and many churches are doing events like this. In a very first event, one of the Christians raised their hand and said, well, Imam Mahmoud, would you tell us, what can we do to work towards peace? And his answer was revolutionary. He says, read the gospel and obey it. And I was stunned in a good sense in realizing, I've never met a Muslim that is not respected and honored a true follower of Jesus.
When I was at Walmart one night, and this happened quite recently, this veteran in a wheelchair came up to me, and for a second I was kind of apprehensive, like, what does a war veteran have to say to me, if he's been overseas, or, he thinks something, he might have a wrong perception of Muslims. And he came up to me and he said, I'm glad that you cover. And I was like, what? Because I couldn't hear him properly, and I was just shocked. And he said, I'm glad that you cover. And I was like, thank you so much. I really appreciate that. And he said, because the Bible tells us to cover too. And I thought, wow, I was like, that's true. And I was like, and I really appreciated him taking that time out to, let me know that. And so there are so many experiences that I could go on and on.
When people come to this beautiful country, like myself, they come into the land of freedom, the land of opportunity, the land that respects human dignity. Let me speak specifically about Muslims. We have so many doctors, engineers, hardworking people who really work very hard to provide education for their children, to improve the condition of their family. And they are here to really to participate in building America.
Our business is, yes, we are in the business because it's a lucrative business, but at the same time...
I want to try to find another clip that's got Imani in it that I think is really interesting stuff. It's good. You notice that Imani plays a very important role in this, in the way this whole thing is communicated. You've got Imam Majid there, who's a really big wheel in American Muslim circles. At the time, he was the president of the Islamic Society of North America. And he's a good guy, but he's stiff. He's clergy-like. He's not the most accessible character. But he says some things that you need to hear. He makes some statements about, the presence of Muslims in the country. Okay. But the stories that Imani tells, they're the important ones. They're the things that people latch on to. She's talking about her experience, and she's got those eyes. Did you notice that? Did you notice those eyes that are just so, she's just darting around, and there's just excitement in her expressions, and she's engaging to look at. And this I found is the real gift of video. How many times have you guys tried to hold conferences and stuff, and there are people standing on the platform that just bore everybody to tears? And by their lack of ability to connect with their audience is a hindrance. It hinders the message. Well, the wonderful thing about video is that you can throw those things on the cutting room floor, And you can bring forth the voices that do connect with the audience the most. And I felt like Imani was always someone who could, you know, who could really connect with that audience and do it in a way that was that made a point and got a point across that that was really helpful and useful. This is a good story that she tells, and I think it's important to hear this.
In this complex and sometimes heated context, people went about practicing their faith.
I look at hijab as complete, like, freedom. You know, because I wasn't told that you have to wear this or that this is something that you have to do, otherwise you're going to be, you know, disowned or, you know. So this was a personal decision that I made that I wanted to start covering. And since then, I've realized so much that it's, you know, it's God's commandment because it's a protection. And you see that, you know, in your everyday life. And I remember very vividly in 7th or 8th grade, I was sitting in a classroom and it was some off time or something. And so there was a group of people and we were sitting and talking, and there was a boy who was judging the girls based on their chest size. And I was just like, oh my goodness. And then he came to me and he was like, well, we can't tell because she's covered. And I was like, thank God, you know, like, because it's so empowering for a woman to be judged based on what she says and how she acts rather than what she looks like and what she's displaying of herself. You know, like, since when was freedom defined by how little our clothes are?
So, you know, just in that one little clip, I've gotten more comment about that than probably the whole film. And that in itself is an eye-opener. And people are willing to take a perspective seriously that they never heard before. And a lot of it really is in how you communicate it, who you choose as the messenger, how you frame it, and all of that. So I'm going to shift gears a little bit now, but anybody got a question about that aspect, the visual aspect of things that I'm trying to promote and pioneer a little bit? All right. Going, gone. All right. So we're here to talk about kind of the state of things as I see it from good old Washington, D.C. I don't know if you've heard this, but D.C. is a bubble. It's this own little thing, and I'm already finding out that my opinions and my understanding of things is skewing in a certain direction that puts me automatically at odds with where the rest of the country's going. So, in other words, I'm already just after being there 2 years, I'm already starting to succumb to the kind of the inside the beltway thinking. So that needs to be said so that you can take what I'm saying as a grain of salt. I feel like in Washington especially, interfaith cooperation is at an all-time high. We had the occasion to go to a reception at the El Hibri Foundation in Washington, which is a Muslim family that has a large foundation, and their primary task of the foundation is to promote Islam and American Muslims and interfaith work. And so this awards presentation took place, and it was a room full of people that I looked around and I thought, well, this is the family reunion for interfaith activists. This is the cream of the crop here, and it was a big room. I mean, Daryl was there, and Trina was there, and it was, and she keeps downplaying. She said, well, I'm not the cream of the crop. I said, yeah, you are, because you were there. But it was a really exciting event, and it was full of the presentations that were made were full of all kinds of hope, all kinds of angst and pathos, love. I mean, real love and respect and admiration for each other, which I found to be to be candid, I've really had a hard time finding a church in Washington to go to, and I looked around in that crowd. I said, "These are my people," and it was pretty exciting stuff. So I would say that in that regard, interfaith work and interfaith cooperation is at an all-time high. There's a growing number of people who understand just how important it is, how vital it is to be engaged in, and there are more resources available financially and otherwise to do interfaith work. There's more quality work being done, I think. More ways that grassroots communities are getting engaged on this issue, and that people are being put face to face and learning about each other. So I find that to be very, very encouraging. However, we all know that interfaith tensions in this country are probably at an all-time high, or at least the highest that they've been in my lifetime, maybe in 100 years, since World War II, when we interned Japanese, perhaps. It is a dangerous time, and Muslims are feeling this especially. They feel especially singled out. They're looking at themselves and saying, why? Why is this happening? I don't know how many Muslims I've talked to, and I'm sure you have too, who will report that any time there's any kind of act of violence that takes place in the country, a shooting or anything that takes place, their first thought is, please, please, God, don't let this be a Muslim. Please don't let this be a Muslim. And there is this constant trauma and re-traumatization of American Muslims over the issue of terrorism, always having to make statements about it. One of the groups that I work with in the Methodist building, the Shoulder to Shoulder campaign, along with conversations with the Islamic Society of North America, I think for at least a time made up their minds and said, no, we will not go on the air and issue a statement denouncing this terrorist act. You wouldn't ask your Christians to do it. You wouldn't ask anybody else to do it. We're not going to do it because we're no less responsible for this act of terrorism than any other faith group is. So for a time, and I think this is still the case, the messaging was, you know, I mean, for a time it was. It was respond to every single thing, issue a statement every time something happened. And then that stopped because the statement was tacitly being made. We're kind of, yeah, those are our crazy cousins over there, and we have to apologize for them all the time. Now it's like, nope, we're not going to comment on it because we shouldn't have to. So we'll find out if that's a good strategy or not. I don't know. But the other thing that's happening is that the Sikh community is getting caught up in this stuff too. The Sikh community, people who don't understand religious diversity get Sikhs confused with Muslims. Or maybe they just don't care, and they indiscriminately are attacking people that they don't understand. However, the Sikh community, which in my estimation is probably one of the most peaceful communities and just such nice people, but the Sikh community is having to be proactive now in ways that they never were. And I think that's really just happened in the last couple of years. But the Sikh community is having to be proactive in ways that they really, really had never been in order to say, not just, hey, don't beat us up, we're not Muslims, but to say, we stand with our Muslim brothers and sisters against all of this kind of faith-based violence. So that's an interesting development, and I think a very positive development. And again, the Know Your Neighbor campaign that I've been working on is headed up by a young man who is a Sikh activist and has chosen to make this a big part of his life, even though he's employed at the White House, but he works on trade policy instead of interfaith. So it's just, he just does it because it needs to be done. And I think that's where you see most of the good stuff happening. It's people who just decide to do it because it needs to be done. So I'll just kind of finish up by saying something about the Know Your Neighbor campaign. Again, Gerwin Ahuja, calls a bunch of people up and asks asks the heads of all these organizations around D.C. To be part of this this campaign and this coalition that he's building. Some heads came. Some heads sent their underlings to go to the meetings, and I ended up being part of that, and it was a good thing because they didn't have any communicators on the steering committee. But after about a year, we held a launch event. After working for about 6 months, we had produced a video, developed a website, knowyourneighbor.us, and we had developed a video, a YouTube video, that was to kind of illustrate what we were about, you know. And the video, several respondents from different faiths and an atheist female were asked basically, what do people misunderstand about your faith background? What kind of questions do you get that show people that they don't really get it? And it's funny. It's just funny. And it's the same kind of thing where, you know, that camera's sitting on their face for a little while, and you have a chance to see them, to encounter them as human beings, and hear the kind of, oh, I wish they would, you know. One guy, he's Egyptian. He's an Egyptian Muslim, and he says, you know, the craziest thing I've ever been asked is, this guy asked me, are you Egyptian? And he says, yeah. He says, no, you can't be Egyptian. The Egyptians are extinct. And, you know, and just it's funny because it's just things that people say. And I get that question a lot around my triplets. I've got triplets, and I've got two boys and a girl, and people are always asking me, well, are they identical? So, you know, but anyway, the point of it is not the content. The point of the video is the connection that it provides. But then the campaign goes on from there. One of the most exciting pieces of the whole campaign is we're working with the ING group out in California that is creating a map. And this might be a really good place for EMU to plug in, but they're creating a web-based map that shows locations of places where interfaith work is taking place. And then it provides the contact information and so on. And that's all underway. That's not complete yet, so I don't know if you'll be able to access that map or not. But it is trying to, you know, use map technology, you know, online, all this wonderful technology we have, so that you can, if you're interested in joining some kind of interfaith program, you can find out where one is in your neighborhood. And I think that's a really exciting development. So I'll just kind of sum all this up and leave it open for questions if you want to ask. But it's an exciting time to be involved in interfaith work. It feels more important than in my life than it ever has for me, but it also it feels every day like we are closer and closer to falling over the knife's edge on this. And I made my shows on the early church or the church's response to the early Nazi years. I made those films because I really saw the potential for the anti-Muslim sentiment to go that way, for us to decide that it's Muslims in our context who are the enemy, and to start really doing. Thank God we haven't had a massive, you know, 9/11 scale attack again, but the potential of that still lies out there. And with the kind of rhetoric we've had in the political campaign this year, and the way that primarily Donald Trump has allowed, he's kind of let the lid off of it, where it was unpopular and impolite to talk, to say hateful things. Now, the lid's off, and it's free to do whatever you want, and people are doing it. And Muslims who comprise a big, what's the number now, 6 million Americans, they're hurting. They're hurting really bad, and a lot of other faith groups are getting caught up in the hurt. So now's the time. It's the time to be involved in this kind of stuff. So questions? Knife edge. I mean that there's been maybe it's a poor choice of words, but I feel like we've been kind of sitting on the edge for a long time, about to fall off into some really bad and violent behavior, and that we've been sitting at the edge of it for a very long time, and we've maintained it, and we've maintained civility. And even in those civil times in the 2000s, we were still looking at some fairly major act of violence against a mosque or a Muslim community or a Muslim person every week in this country. Now that has skyrocketed. In the last year, I think those attacks are up something like 80%. It's critical, and that's what I mean. It's starting to get to that tipping point. I guess that's really what I'm trying to say. It's at a tipping point where, given the right circumstances, it could be very, very ugly for some of the most beautiful people I know, and that bothers me.
What is that context? Urban, American? What's the context where the ugliness did occur?
It's happening everywhere. It's happening in sophisticated places like New York City. It's happening in rural communities all over the country. It's happening everywhere.
What is the pullback? What do you see that is your job? What is the pullback potential?
What do you mean pullback potential?
What are our strengths, and I'm saying our, assuming we all here, we want to move in the direction of dialogue, of collaboration, et cetera. What brings that about and gets us off the edge?
So I think that it behooves all of us. Again, I'm very formed by ideas that are present in the Sermon on the Mount, and I think that idea of the kingdom being like leaven in a loaf, being like a mustard seed, being like salt and light, all of those ideas that we've been living with are now, really practical, because it takes you and me having a real change of heart and other people seeing it. And now we've got social media that can amplify that message. So, years ago, I started working on this when I was in my 30s, and I was pretty stupid, pretty uninformed, But I started little bit by bit letting people know, this is something that's important to me, and I'm not going to give in to hateful talk. I'm not going to be part of it. And especially around 9/11, there was plenty of it around me. People didn't know where I stood very well, and people were letting it loose. And I decided at that point, I'm not gonna let it pass. I'm not gonna let it happen. So people around me know how I feel on this. And I have some fun Facebook experiments where I'll post something about, Iraqi prisoners being tortured at Abu Ghraib or something like that, and you get one or two people that like it, and then just to check to make sure everybody's listening, anybody's listening, I'll put a picture of my kid up or something, and I get 250 likes. I'm like, okay, well then they saw the other piece too, but people know where I stand, and people need to know where you stand, and that I think is one of the big things. That's something everybody can do.
We have a political sign in our yard. It's the first time in 2 years of marriage that Ashton and I are not canceling each other out. But I know that's not what you mean.
Right.
My further question is, in Mennonite circles, the discussion is Muslims and Christians. My family has been in Korea,
mm-hmm.
where Japanese tourists with a lot of money are not served by Korean mom-pop stores who need the money because of the history of oppression.
Yeah.
And just the news of this week, the president, a woman of great capability, has been influenced by shamanism and is accepted shamanism as her religion, according to news media, which takes her thinking religiously way back. And we have some experience with that, having been there. And there's great hostility between the shamanism and the Western thinking, which controls Korea. It's very, very modern. Because missionaries came in and destroyed everything, culture, beliefs, and everything, years and years ago. How are we processing with that? Or we just don't go there. We just stay with the Middle East.
Well, I mean, it's context, really, because you're talking about a context that I really don't have much contact with, and most Americans don't. So, so the reason why I talk about Muslim Christian is not because of the Middle East, because Muslims are everywhere, but it's purely because this is a uniquely American problem right now. It's European too, but it's. But it is a problem that is getting worse and worse and worse and worse. So, you know, if any of us are in the anti-racism business, there's plenty of we're going to be in business for a while. You know, there's plenty of ways to see it. There's also, I think, what I would say to what you said, there's also, and you know it, I'm a big fan of what Mark Gopin and Joseph Montville out of George Mason have tried to develop, which is this idea of healing historical memory. I don't know very much. This is where I'm really intimidated in this crowd. Is that, you know, you guys are the scientists. You're the people that are putting real substance to these ideas and real practices. And all I know is I'm just kind of familiar with them, and I have my own kind of ideas about how to do reconciliation. But I know that a big component in most conflicts is who shot first, and, you know, how do you figure that out, and how do you make it right? That's a no. You can't win that one. But the big issue is the pain of historical memory and how that's brought forward, how that is perpetuated, how politicians benefit from perpetuating those kinds of animosities, and how do you deal with it? How do you address it? So I think that's a big piece, and I'm.
So you mentioned this already. I mean, I think regardless of who wins next week in the presidential,
mm-hmm.
the lid is off the can. But what are your thoughts about first strategic steps if Mr. Trump would win? Like, what are you thinking about would be the most important things to focus on early on?
So your question was, and this is for the podcast, your question is basically what are first steps to do if Donald Trump is elected next week?
Yeah, where would you put the energy?
I would say that we are in just as much trouble if Hillary wins, not because of what we fear Hillary will do, but because of what we believe that Donald Trump and his followers will do in response to a Hillary victory. So I think that this is going to be something we're going to have to address next week, no matter what. I don't know. I feel like there will be a lot of people talking about, well, I'm just leaving. I'm going to go to Canada, and I'm going to go to New Zealand, and they're just going to want to leave. And they won't be able to leave physically, so they'll try to leave spiritually and emotionally, and they'll try to just kind of, you know, I'm not going to do this. And what my response has been, well, I'm not leaving, I'm joining the resistance. And I think that it's going to take that kind of mentality on the part of millions of people that we are going to stay engaged. We're not going to be discouraged, but in fact, we're going to see this as the moment that we were all put here on this earth for, and that we are going to, I mean, just very naively, I'm going to say we're just going to charge ahead with loving people. And I think that's what we all have to do first thing in the morning on Wednesday. Now, that's not a very satisfactory answer, I don't think. But I do think that one thing we've been trying to do is to gain access to both political campaigns. We have not been able to do that. We feel like we can probably get a meeting with the Hillary transition team if she's elected. We're doubtful that we're going to be able to get to have any access with the Trump campaign or the Trump transition team if he's elected. But I think it's going to have to mean that we all persevere on those things until somebody gets a meeting. And I think in the world of interfaith and peacemaking and everything, a lot of us really don't like working together. And I think we're going to have to work together. I think it's the time for it. We have to work together. We have to have common cause, and we have to have common strategies. Yes?
So the estimates of Muslim Americans actually range from 3 million to 6 million, but it's 1 to 2% of the population.
Yeah.
And the research on ethno-religious persecution around the world is that the smaller the percentage of the minority group, the more risk they are.
Mm-hmm.
So demagogues around the world target minority groups. And I've seen some of this in Egypt with the experience of the Coptic evangelicals, also about 1% of the population. They feel because their women don't veil sometimes.
Yeah.
So to some degree, this is a human phenomenon.
Right.
And we do have an obligation to stand with minority groups where they are targeted. But I'm wondering how we get beyond that human need to project our problems onto some minority group and therefore assume that if we can do something with them, our problems are solved. It's happened all over the world.
But there have been times when we've done better at this, right? I mean, and that's the part I try to figure out. This is something of a new problem for us.
No, it's not. If you look at Germany,
yeah.
World War I, Japanese Americans, World War II, Muslim Americans now, this is not.
But what about, yeah, okay, I mean, you're right. I mean, have there been times when we've done it better?
There have been times when we've been even worse. That you mentioned the internment of Japanese Americans.
Thanks a lot, man. You're helping.
Although I think we're only a small step away from internment if you listen.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah. Yeah, absolutely.
Have there been places in Appalachia where a mosque and a synagogue and a church are in rural Tennessee and people are holding festivals together? Had that happened?
It's fluid.
Historically?
Yeah, it's fluid. And it comes and goes, and sometimes you can make it happen, and sometimes you can't. And Johnson City, Tennessee, is a good example of that. The Muslim community center was originally it was right next to it was a very nondescript place. It was right next to Muncie United Methodist Church, which is one of the big tall steeple churches, and they kept a pretty low profile, but there was an awareness and it, you know, it all seemed to work. Then the Muslim community moved out to a really nice new building, a little bit out on the outskirts of town, and that raised their stature in the community. And my sense is that that's all gone pretty well in little old Johnson City. Now it's a college town, so, you know, but it's still Appalachia in a big way. But I think, again, my sense is that it kind of ebbs and flows. Sometimes it's working well, and sometimes, you know, I think in this country things work pretty well most of the time. If you look at it, it's always the political campaigns that get this stuff stirred up. It's always peaks. All this stuff peaks at the time of the political campaigns.
I think there's a wrinkle that is being overlooked.
Okay.
Pretty much everyone, and I think you brought it up very well, in a sense that... In World War I and World War II, we were experiencing what I would call modern war. The internment of Japanese Americans, the internment of German Americans, if anything helped the war effort, it was wrong, it probably didn't help much. But the principle is, you go and you bomb the other side into submission. In postmodern war, when you have a radical Muslim group, for example, in order to be successful, they need us to hate moderate Muslims. So when we take those same steps, we're actually working against ourselves. We are defeating ourselves because that radicalizes the people that we're persecuting, gives these people more support. They know that. They need that. So in a sense, when we persecute moderate Muslims for what a radical Muslim did, we're ISIS supporters.
Well, yeah.
We're working for them. I know we're also working for those people in our culture that would love to go bomb the heck out of somebody.
And this leads me to an article that I read in a Council on Foreign Relations publication right after 9/11. Boy, that makes me sound smart, doesn't it? But it was a an article that I read that said that proposed it was answering the question the why do they hate us question, which was of course right after 9/11. That was a big one. George Bush said they hate us because we're free. But this guy says, you know, that's the wrong question. The question should be, why are they trying to provoke us? And he went through the history of terrorism, you know, from Al-Qaeda terrorism back to the embassy bombings that took place in Africa. We reacted. We bombed an aspirin factory. Didn't really engage with them. So then they kick it up a notch and they bomb the USS, the Cole, you know. And, yeah, it got us, but no big thing. And everybody knows that they could have, if they wanted to, just cause mass casualties. There are any number of ways they could have done that that would cause much greater casualties. And this guy actually made the case that the Twin Towers and the Pentagon and so on were all limited targets in a certain sense. In other words, enough force to get us really ticked off, but merciful in a certain way. Now, I know that's highly controversial to even say it. Symbolic targets, but the idea was that it was a provocative move. And what were they provoking us to do? Well, they wanted us to join their own civil war, which the writer was proposing that, you know, what's really at work there is a battle that's going on in the Muslim world for the hearts of Muslim people. And then that almost tends to make sense when you look at the fact that most of the big terrorist acts that have taken place since 9/11 have ended in the deaths of Muslims, not Westerners. So I think what you point at is the real intention of this kind of polarization that we're experiencing, and that we're actually playing our part in it as Americans by becoming more and more afraid. And we are actually playing into the narrative that other people want us to play into. Yes, sir.
I'm in the intercultural business, not just interfaith, but across all kinds of differences, because that's my understanding of the gospel,
mm-hmm.
where the gospel puts us. You've spoken about, there have been several questions about, all right, what do we do next? And fine, I can update a Facebook page.
Right.
We can have our own individual organizations. There are thousands of organizations here in the United States all working on interfaith issues, on the Muslim side, on the Christian side, with the Buddhists and the Sikhs and everybody else. But there is no common place where the people who belong, whose hearts belong to the in-between, right, whose hearts belong to the inter-world, even whose allegiances belong to the inter-world, who don't accept lines, political boundaries drawn in the sand as defining some great moral distinction between whom I ought to kill and whom I ought to defend, I want a flag. I want a flagship. I want some sort of place where we can come together, all these people who belong to the in-between, to have a common agenda. And what are the prospects for that? I haven't seen that raise its head yet. I mean, I've tried to run a flag up a pole. Nobody salutes. Everybody is still running their own game, trying to come at it from their own perspective, which is good. We need to bring our different perspectives. I'm not hoping for a homogeneity or an assimilation into one group. This truly needs to be a place where people come in their differences to work together. How do we make that happen?
Well, I would love to see. Okay, I think you've got. There's the world that I live in, which is all the practitioners. We're all trying to do it from different angles. There's some groups that are grassroots organizations trying to do it. There are grass tops organizations like ours that are trying to do it, and we're all scratching our heads about it. Seems to me that the expertise on how to do it actually lies here at Eastern Mennonite University. I'm sorry, I don't mean to give you too much credit, but I really do think that this university specifically has resources that nobody else has. And so what if, you know, what if, I'll just throw it out there, what if the NCC decides to be the flagship for holding some kind of collaborative process where the theoreticians and the scientists on peace building get together with the practitioners and we really work this thing. We really work it so that the knowledge can be carried out into the world and at least we give it the best shot we possibly can. I'm not sure there is an answer. I really don't. I think it's possible that it may have to get a whole lot worse before it gets better. There's some social science that would seem to agree with that, but I would really like to avoid that. But I think that putting the scientists together with the practitioners has a possibility of getting us at least all working off of an intelligent page together. That's the best answer I can. I don't think that's a good answer at all, but I think that's the best answer I can give you.
John, you should start your own movement. The Liminalist Society. Liminalists, those in the middle, those on the edges.
Yeah.
Yeah, well, I think it's a good place to wrap it up, so thank you all for coming.
Thank you very much. Really great.